Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a huge honour and privilege to be here and to really excited to, for the first time to visit Northern Ireland and to visit this beautiful city, Belfast. First, I have to say that do forgive me with my English difficulties, but also I speak quite fast. I think Ruth is here somewhere to tell me to slow down. She normally does that, so you are aware. I'm going to share my story with you, and in hope that we will have better understanding. And it's one story, but hopefully will be representations of the many thousands, if not millions, up story. And that's why I wrote The Lightless Sky, to inform people, to educate them about how it's not about statistics. As Patrick said, it's about real life. It's about real life suffering in humans. I wanted to give it a human face. So I'm going to start maybe from a very early stage. As a child, so in Afghanistan, I was born when the Taliban actually took power in 1994, which is equivalent to 1373, the Afghan calendar. When somebody asks me, age is like a big issue for me. People say, how old am I? I'm like, age is just a number. So I was born in the 1300. So when I was born, obviously before that, there was huge conflicts and civil war in Afghanistan after the Russian withdrawals, the Soviet Union, you know, breakout, and they left Afghanistan. Then there was a civil war. My father was very much involved before the civil war with the Mujahideen, and he was a doctor as well as a freedom fighter. So when I was growing up at the age of about four, I moved out of our family home. I went and stayed with my grandparents in the mountain in eastern Afghanistan, where we had sheep and animals. What we used to do is, in winter, we used to go to the warm parts of eastern Afghanistan. It used to take us weeks to travel with 250-300 sheep and different types of animals, including camels and donkeys and horses. I don't know how would I describe it. I don't really had a childhood, but the childhood that I had, I'm very grateful for, because I got to spend time with my grandparents, and I got so much wisdom from them, and so much. I learned so much about history, about my life personally, and I learned about, you know, religion. I learned about where we came from, how our grandparents ended up in where we ended up. And it was, for me, I didn't want to live with my family, with my parents or the extended family. We had a huge family, about 25 to 30 people in the house, with like huge 10 bedroom house with a wall around it, and a big guest room. So after some time, about 2000, when I was about 6-7, we had to sell all the animals and sheep, because my father and my uncles, who were educated, they thought it was shameful for them to have their father and their mother in mountains and their old age to have sheep. It was somehow very, you know, to live a nomadic life wasn't a nice thing. But in fact, my grandparents and I really enjoyed it, and we wanted to. It was really peaceful. It was a it was a great time. You know, I get to know the animals really well, and they get to know me. We could really understand each other. There was this love in friendship, which I sometimes find it hard. Sometimes I don't really find it in humans, but I found it with animals, which was great at this really, even very young age. So I was sadly forced to go to school. I didn't want to go to school. I hated it for the first few months. I know people used to fight with me. They used to steal my pens, and I didn't know how to write stuff. And I was like, I just want to go and do like my, just want to go ride my horse, or just go with like, I used to go underneath the sheep just to drink fresh milk. So we started school, and it was a different types of life and different experience back in the family home with the rest of the family, my siblings. I had three brothers, two sisters, and many cousins. And aunties and uncles. So from there, I not only continued to study, but also tried to learn to become a tailor, because two of my uncles were tailors making Afghan clothes, the shalwar kameez, and then we used to get really busy during Eid holidays or Eid times or some celebrations, special occasions. And then I used to help my dad in his GP surgery, as well as his drugstore place. And I had my own shop as well, a small shop where I was selling like, you know, threads and stuff, like for the uncles and others in the bazaar. So I was, from a very young age, I was taught to be responsible, to behave, to have manners, and there was things that I find it difficult to find in school in the UK with some people, which was a bit unfortunate. But for me, I just learned it from a very early stage. Things changed when I was in year 4 or 5. Well, actually, before that, even when I was in year one, when the U.S. Invasion took place, because my uncle was a commander in the Taliban, and my family had a very close link to the government of the day. It's kind of normal in societies like Afghanistan, where because when there's a government, you literally take sides. You can't really be in between. And I think my family wasn't really happy of my uncle being with the Taliban, but it was a decision that he made, and he wanted to be there to have a voice and to ensure that we had some sort of power and influence, and we did. So we were quite well up in terms of, you know, no one really could mess about with us, because my uncle was a really important person in the government. But one day the government collapsed. This is the time I remember more than any other time, is that I could see the planes and airplanes and rockets and bombardments. I used to go with my mom and the other women of the house and with my other siblings to find to a bunker to where they built it during the Russian, the Soviet invasion, and we used to hide there. But we literally lived in constant fear. And one of the reasons, I mean, like one of the way I describe it is, though in Britain we hear the sound of cars and the sound of cuts, which is great, but there I grew up in a war zone. In a war zone, it's very frightening. And after some time, you kind of get used to it. It just become normalized. You know, after a few months, when the war kind of started, and the war kind of ended after the bombing of, I don't know, 1 week or so, and because we were living quite close to where Osama bin Laden was based, and that made it more harder because there was more bombing in our parts of Afghanistan than anywhere else. It was strange when the bombing stopped, and then we were thinking, you know, why is there no bombing? Why is there no plane? It became part of life, and it really affects not only children, but it affects anyone. I mean, it's a war zone. But moving on, after some time, they go on, and my uncle kind of escaped after being one of the last person to hold the ground in the district or in the provinces of eastern Afghanistan. I think he went to Pakistan, and then so does like every other Taliban. And he came back, and he kind of made a deal with the new government or the new governor. And the new governor, interestingly, made him in charge of the prison service, which was really funny. I mean, like, I think about it now, because all the people in prison were the Taliban fighters. And there was my uncle, who was himself a Taliban commander, and he was in charge of prison service in eastern Afghanistan. So after that, it becomes even harder for my family to kind of maintain its neutrality, because the Taliban was kind of coming back in 2004, in 5. To start the resurgency and to say, look, we need to fight the invasions and the occupation. Afghans and Afghanistan has always been free, and we can't really accept. You know, we fought against the Russians and we fought against the British in the 1800s, 3-4 times, and here we are now. We're not fighting against those invaders, as we call them, occupiers, but even more so those infidels who invaded our country. And there was a huge sense of responsibility that every Afghan felt, especially those Afghans who had links or who were sympathetic to the Taliban. And their ideology, of course. I mean, whenever I'm doing interviews, I say, look, the Taliban's done some pretty bad things, and they've done some terrible things. But at the same time, I think when they came, they brought some hope, and according to my parents and my grandparents, that before they came, there was a civil war. Up to a million people were killed. And literally in every district, in each province, each village, it has its own warlord. The country was lawless. There was no law and order. But when they came, they literally brought hope, but also security and stability. But yes, they've done a lot of bad things too. Maybe me in the West, we only hear about one side of the perspectives, which is that's how the media works. So we my family kind of between was to kind of make both sides happy. The Americans wanted you know, information. So there's the Afghan government, which wasn't really elected yet. It was the transitional government. In majority of the people in the government then, or still is kind of, is those people who are anti-Taliban, who the Taliban oppressed and Taliban imprisoned, as well as they were warlords, and they had a lot of power, and they still do. So those people, in a way, they kind of wanted to oppress my family, or to take revenge, or to just cause problem for us. But so we, either way, we couldn't really make both sides happy. And sadly, a few incidents happens. The Americans came to our house so many times with the Afghan allies. The issue we have in Afghanistan is going to somebody's house at night with guns and with the intention of, you know, an operation, a night raid, is very unacceptable to Afghans. I mean, if you go to an Afghan house as a guest, as a visitor, you're welcome anytime, and they will treat you to the best of hospitality. But if you go there to disrespect their women and disrespect the norms and the culture, It's very unacceptable, no matter who you are. So sadly, in one of the incidents, they came in and they literally, you know, disrespected the woman and kicked things around in the house and wanted to look for weapons and fighters, which could have been the case. The Taliban could have been stayed in our house because we couldn't say no to them because you were in the situation that you just want to make everybody happy, but we were not involved directly. My dad was still a doctor treating patients in hospitals. And so one day, incident occurred where four or five members of my family were killed in a fight with the US forces. And thankfully, me and my brother was not home. And it was an incident that kind of changed everything. And I don't like talking about it, and I don't like going back to the things that I saw, that I experienced. I described it in my book, the certain acts and certain actions, for example, of the Taliban that I saw, and certain acts and actions of the US forces that I saw really affected me, and still does to this day. Just recently, actually 2 days ago, my brother called me. He lives with me. And he says, you were screaming last night. You were shouting. Is everything okay? So sometime at night, I wake up, I scream, I shout, I talk in my sleep. Because, you know, what happens is with the refugee crisis or what's happening, people are drowning in the sea. Just today, 200 people, or yesterday, people drowned in the boat. And what the things that I saw in Afghanistan kind of come back to me. And it's really hard. So the incident happened, and after that, we were kind of expected, me and my brother, to, you know, my uncle were arrested, and we were in a serious trouble. We were expected by the Taliban to join them, and to not only fight to take revenge for our family members and for our loved ones, but also to fight the invaders. It was our duty, and to become fighters. And on the other hand, the US forces, or the US allied, or the Afghans who we knew, family friends who were working for the US, wanted us to become informants to give them information about the Taliban. So we were between this great game, and I say it as a between a hard place and a rock. We couldn't really do much. So that's how my mom came to a conclusion. My mother had to make this decision that to send me and my brother away, and it was a very unexpected decision, because for us, as even though it's young boys of 12, 11, 13, we were expected to protect the family honor, even if that means cost of our own life. The decision was made by my mother, which was very unusual, to send us away to the unknown. I had no idea what was happening. We started the journey. We went to the tribal areas in Pakistan. My grandma was heavily involved. She's one of the most important person to me because of the time that I spent with her, and how she was a midwife. And I kind of started one of the book chapter and how I used to go with her to people's houses in the district where ladies used to give birth. And that was kind of, I used to hold her hands with, she was an old lady. So my grandma had a big role in my other male family relatives. So to keep it short, we started the journey, me and my brother together, from Pakistan. And then we were separated immediately. Mom wanted us to stay together, but then we couldn't really do anything about it. I started the journey, I went to Iran, and then from there I went to Turkey. My passport was taken away, the passport that I had, whether it was real or fake. And in Turkey I walked overnight and crossed the border illegally. The Iranian border guards shot at us, and sometimes I would be with 10 people or 5 people, sometimes I would be on my own, sometimes I would be with thousands of people. And I spent quite a few months in Turkey, in Istanbul, trying to get to Bulgaria or Greece. And I still didn't have, I had no idea what was happening, where I was going, and the uncertainty was really bothering me. And I had no contact with brother. I was thinking about my brother, what happened to him, and was missing home as well. Because this was something that I never thought this would happen to me. It just happened from the unknown, like from nowhere. And then I went through, from Turkey, I went to Bulgaria, and like on the sill of the trains, I was fitting to the top of the trains. And then at one point I was taken down, and it's like, jump. And I was like, jump? What jump? My face was all black, and I was kind of half asleep. And I looked out, and there was the train was moving, but moving slowly. So it was half an hour or so before the police checkpoints, we were jumping. Somehow the guy pushed me to jump, and I jumped. And I ended up in hospital, and I saw the people who jumped with me, most of their legs and hands were broken, and some were seriously injured. But I was the lucky one. I somehow managed to land on the grass and land balance. And I was small, I was very small, so it helped. And then I was arrested in Bulgaria. Not only wasn't I treated as a child, but I wasn't even treated as a human. So they deported me back to Turkey in snow. It was winter, I think in 2006, December. around that time, or later on. It was really cold. And luckily, I was not arrested. I managed to make it back to Istanbul, to the place I was staying with the agents and human traffickers and smugglers, which I kind of explained in details of how the networks works and how it's fascinating in wealth structure. And it amazes me how it's like a very clever business for those people. Some of them are very heartless. Majority of them are very, you know, they see you as a commodity. They see you as money-making machine. But some of them are kind of actually, you know, they want to help you. They want to support you. And they understand your pain. So sometime again in Turkey, and then I was arrested before going again on the trips, either to Greece. The agents were always lied to us. And I was sent back to Iran. The Turkish authority treated me really badly, and then so does in Iran. But thankfully, I managed to escape, literally, from the police prison bus with a few friends, and it was funny as well as serious escape. Which, if we had made a very little mistake, we would have been shot at. We would have been killed because they had an order to shoot. You know, if you run away from the Iranian police, they shoot you. It's as simple as that. And then I made it back to Turkey the second time. Same travel through nights walking through Turkey, try to avoid checkpoints, and then to make it to Istanbul back again. And after some time, actually after like almost 9-10 months, finally there was a trip to Greece. We were taken to a place called Izmir, port of Izmir, and in a back of a van, which was very like small van, like a white van, and 35 people or so in each. It was really small. It was a really hot day. And then in Izmir, we were supposed to board the ship to Greece. The boat did not arrive, so we stayed in like, we call it a jungle, but it was like a forest. For 3 nights, our food, everything ran out. And this happens to a lot of people, those people who are making the journeys even now, that the agents or the traffickers or human smugglers lied to you, and you are kind of left to wonder, you know, what's happening. And we were there for 3 nights. We came to the conclusion that we want to go and give ourselves into the police because the hunger and thirst was unbearable. I tried to go into the sea to drink the water, which actually made it worse. And then after 3 days, the boat arrived. And then the guys came back, the Kurdish, the Turkish Kurd, who are our human smugglers, came with the tomatoes and some water and Turkish bread. It's called ekmek. So half of it is like literally very small. We had something. We were grateful, as always. You know, we count it as a blessing. Every little things on the journey was appreciated. And we went to the boat. They took us in a small boat, to the big boat, and then. The so-called big boat was not big. So there was 120 of us. The boat was designed for about 20 people. It was a tourist boat. And we were supposed to be in Greece within a few hours, but we ended up traveling for 50 hours. Without water, without food, everything ran out. And there was no space to stretch. Literally, my body gave up. I could not move. I literally sat in one place. At night, I used to go on the top of the deck, which was kind of nice. Some guys were inside. Some of my friends was inside. And I really felt sorry for them, even though I was in pain, but they were like so much, there was so much smell there, and it was like dark, 24/7 they were there, and really kind of pumped into each other. And if things wasn't getting worse, the boat broke down in the middle of the Mediterranean. And one thing in my head was that, you know, if I die, I die, that's okay, you know, we all die. But I don't want to die in this sea, I don't want to die in the middle of nowhere, and my family, my mom would never know where my body is. I think sometimes, you know, when a relative dies, and it's shocking, it's really sad. I mean, I'm sure you understand, but when you don't know whether they're dead or alive is the hardest thing. So I understood that. But one thing kind of kept me going was my faith along the journey. My faith really helped me, and I was very faithful, and religion was a big part of my life, and still is. So again, within minutes, if the police had not arrived, we would have been drowned. We would have been killed in the sea. Our boat broke down. Water was coming in. And then we made it to Greece. I remember the kindness of people. There were people waiting for us with food and water. It was unbelievable. I mean, on this journey, I saw kindness of humans to humans, to men. And, you know, I saw cruelty in inhumanity of man to man. But majority of the people were nice that I met along the way. And even a smile in the situation that I was in was priceless. It was great to see people smile at you, and just strangers give you some food, or just look at you with care and compassion and feel for you, which is nice. But I wish I wasn't in that situation. And then sadly, it wasn't, you know, I was, even though I was the only child in the group most of the time, but now we see there's even more children coming. So I continued the journey, made it to Greece, and then in Greece, we were taken to Athens, and then we were given a papers which says that we need to leave Greece within a month. otherwise we'll face deportation. And then later on I found out that we were in prison for 3 months. I was like, great, this makes a lot of sense. You need to leave Greece within a month and then we are in prison for 3 months because we entered Greece illegally. And I was amazed. I was like, even though it's for a 12 years old, it doesn't make sense. And then somehow we managed to go to a UN camp. They take us out because we were children. And then from there we escaped because we still have that paper with us. And then we made it to a place called Patra. From Patra, I was in the back of a lorry engine. And this is where I found out that my brother was heading for Britain. This was the only place after almost 10 months, after 10, 11 months, I found out that he was, this guy had met him, and it was really coincident, but it happened. It was great. So I was even more determined. This was the place where I knew I wanted to go to England. Before that, I had no idea where I was heading, and I didn't have no idea where my family had paid for me to go. And then I made it to Italy, luckily, because there was people who were in this place for months, and I literally made it. I was on top of this engine, a lorry engine, which was really hot, but I managed to sneak in. And when I came out in Italy, but I take out a rock from my small bag and I bounce it under the thing, under the driver's seat. The driver was shocked and I was like, how did he manage? Like, how this happened? It was actually, yeah, it was. He was just telling people on the motor, he's like, look at this guy, what is happening? He thought there was some technical problem in his lorry, but he wasn't. And and then this was the only place, actually, police came and I was so happy they took me. Italy was the only place I was treated as a human, as a child, and with respect and dignity, which was great. And I was taken to a police station and taken to a children's home. After 15 days, I escaped. I ran away. I jumped from the third floor because I felt lonely. I felt a sense of isolation because this was the only time I was on my own. I didn't have my travel companions with me, and it was strange. And also, I wanted to go and find my brother. And there was a huge language barrier. There was nobody to explain anything to me. They found a guy who spoke Farsi. And my Farsi was very weak then, and I spoke Dari, which is similar to Farsi, and then that wasn't really good either. And this guy spoke with a very heavy Italian accent, Farsi, and I was like, yeah, that helps. And then those people were really nice. Those people, I hope one day I'll be able to. This place was somewhere near Bari. So I managed to find the train. I escaped and ran away and made it to Rome, and I was regretting it straight away because Rome was so horrible. There's people sleeping in parks and cardboards, and it was really bad. And then from there, I found the guy who my brother was with because I had a contact from Greece. And then the guy told me everything about my brother after a long time, which was amazing to hear because I was really, really worried for him. And I was like, what is happening to him? And what my mom would be thinking, that we are together, but we weren't together. And then I continued the journey to France and from France to the UK. I spent a month in Calais. In Calais, it felt like 3 months. For the last 8 years, I've been believing that I spent 3 months in Calais because that's how bad it was. I was arrested every day, humiliated by the police, and literally no one was offering any solution or any kind of practical help. I was in the jungle, and actually recently visited Calais back after 9 years, 8 years, and it's even more shocking now. After 8 years, things hasn't improved; things has got worse. The place that I used to go to eat during lunch, that doesn't exist. The place I used to go in the evening to eat, this was the only two places where the police would not arrest me. Everywhere else, they would arrest me. Sometimes, the funny thing was, I used to go to the police station, came out, and the police would arrest me again. And I was like, I just came from the police station. They were like, well, no, because I didn't have no proof of evidence to tell them. Sometimes they would go mad at me, and they put me in prison for 24 hours. Or sometimes they would take me far, far away, so then I had to walk back for 20 hours to get back to the jungle. And when we were in the jungle in the morning, we used to try to go to the lorries, to the car parks, walk for 3-4 hours in cold. To find a lorry, we had kind of human smuggler and was helping me and then some friends. And then either the lorry drivers will take us down. And I would just say to him, look, there's no language skill, but we kind of mix everything together. Like, don't take us out here in the park because it was like 2-3 hours walk back to the jungle. Take us out in the port where the police will take us down. At least it's warm. It's cold walking back in this early morning, but they wouldn't care less. One day I just got lucky, made it in the back of a refrigerator lorry. I had enough of Cali that my 100th attempt or so, and days became weeks, week became months. That's how bad it was. And when I got to Britain, I felt good in a way that I finally made it to my destination. But I was then arrested, which was kind of normal. I got used to it. I was taken to a police station in custody for 24 hours. I was treated better than I was, honestly, I was treated better compared to the rest of Europe, maybe except Italy. Italy was an exception. I was in the hands of strangers. The journey itself was really hard. I describe it as though going through hell. and you know, saw death with my own eyes. But being in the UK first 3 months or year was also as hard as the journey itself. Things got so bad because no one really believed in my age, in my nationality, the Home Office, social services. Even though they tried to support me, but the system was cold. It was unwelcoming. It was somehow that, you know, you shouldn't be here. It made me, I feel like now that it victimizes me and made me feel worthless. And I mean, I was like just a human. Because of circumstances that forced me to leave. I didn't want to leave Afghanistan. I would love to be back there. When people tell me that, you know, when are you going to go back? I love to go back. I want to be with my family. But it's unfortunate that I'm not. And after some time, I managed to challenge them took me 5 years to get my refugee status and to convince the Home Office. And then I went through a lot of difficulties or issues, but there were a lot of, majority of the people were supportive. You know, I had, and then I was able to go to school after challenging my age. And because I was 13 when I arrived, and the social service was telling me, I was too smart, too intelligent, too clever to be 13. And I was like, I'm not any 13, I'm an Afghan 13 years old. And one of the funny thing was, because if you tell an Afghan that you're not an Afghan, that is the biggest insult. You know, they were changing my age completely. They were giving me a new date of birth, new age. I was like, great, that's nice. But don't change my nationality, because that is serious. But no one would understand. No one would bother to investigate. And then I managed to convince them and change and move to, from Kent, I moved to Bolton in Greater Manchester. And then I was able to go to the school called Starting Point, where this was the only place. I actually challenged the age after that. It was the only place this head teacher, Mrs. Katie Khalid, she believed in me. She was like, come to school from tomorrow. I couldn't believe I was hearing that. After like a year of struggling, striving to challenge and make progress and go forward, this was the first time someone believed in me. And then from there, I started the journey to education and to integration and to become a better person. And to in this process, I came to, twice actually, I came to a conclusion to end my life. And I think I was not willing to write this in the book, but I was persuaded by my writer, my co-writer, Nadine Ghouri, she's an amazing lady, and some other friends, that it was important to mention, because the system was so bad that even though I went through so much hell, I still wanted to, you know, even though I had peace, security, and I found my brother, when my brother found me, which was great after some time, and I still wanted to just give up on life, not once, but twice, but thankfully I didn't, and I'm here now, and I'm pleased to be talking to you. So yeah, I went to secondary school. I did quite well. I got 8 GCSEs, English being my fifth language, but I still managed to get 8 GCSEs in 2 years. And not only did I do that, but I also left a legacy behind that. Just recently, my school named an award after me. I don't like praising myself, but I have like this many certificates and I have lots of awards. But the school named an award after me, calling it Gluali Pasalais Award for overcoming adversity, which is great. And the school had been inviting me to achievement evenings to present awards and certificates. This year they invited me to present my own awards to a girl from a refugee camp, I think South Sudan or somewhere Somalia. And it was a moment of pride, but also a moment of humbleness. And I did everything I could to contribute to school life as well as to the community. I was literally involved with, like, until recently, I was involved with like 15 to 20 different commissions, committees and groups, trying to find solutions to child poverty, working with the Children's Society, doing a lot of work around campaigning for refugees' rights and children's rights, empowering young people. Literally, whatever opportunity came my way, I took it. And in 2012, I was recognized for my contribution to the community, and I was selected to carry the Olympic torch, which was a huge honor for me, which was, I really felt, you know, this. That when people want to come to Britain, one of the reasons they want to come here is they feel they will get justice, they will be treated fairly, they will be treated equally. And really, that day I saw, you know, how in Britain, not only did I have a voice, not only did I was, you know, I was doing well, and I was treated as a human, finally, after some struggle, but also I was. It was great to be able to be one of the 8,000 people to carry the Olympic torch and to be part of this history. That day I will never forget. I think it was 23rd June 2012. And I carried the torch in Burnley. And there's a few other things I'm quite proud of, you know, getting to the University of Manchester, which I never thought I'll do. And I think, given the opportunity, refugees or asylum seekers, or if we treat them as humans and we treat them well, we give them the chances in life, they will do well. They will make not only themselves proud, but they will make Britain proud. And I'm intending to continue one day, hopefully, to go back to Afghanistan to end my talk, as to contribute to peace, but also to ensure that people like my mother doesn't have to send her 12 years old son away to the unknown, and to ensure that something happens, and that will not only be in my interest or my country's interest, but that will be in Britain's interest. And one thing I really want Britain to do is to become an education hub, you know, to become a place where it educates people. Just recently I was reading an article that the University of Manchester, there's about 10 University of Manchester graduates who are world leaders. And it's amazing, you know, this huge soft power, having someone educated in Britain. And I mean, for me, I'm in immense gratitude to Britain for giving me safety and for allowing me to stay here, but also for the opportunities in education. So I hope, and I've been giving back, and for the last 4 or 5 years, I literally haven't spent a day without doing something useful or without doing something productive for the society as a whole. And I hope that Britain will change its stance on the current crisis, and maybe we need to show more about human side. I think Britain has a proud history. And again, when people want to come to Britain, it's something that we should be proud of. You know, they see Britain as a place of hope. They see Britain as a place they will be treated fairly. And they're fleeing persecutions and terrific, such a bad things in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. And those wars and conflicts, we shouldn't forget. We also, you know, somehow had a role to play. And I think we should show our love. And I think those refugees right now needs warmth, needs love, and we should welcome them and treat them as normal human being. Thank you very much for listening.